On the 8th episode of the Loose Threads podcast, I talk with Tull Price, the founder of Fight. We had a great talk about how Fight was a reaction to Tull's previous company, why he's most interested in making the best products from the best materials over making money, bucking many trends that have ushered in an era of mass production and globalization, and where the name Fight comes from. Tull is one of those people that really stands out from the rest of the pack in terms of his knowledge about both the industry and kind of the effect it has and the place it has in the world. And I think our talk is very much reflective of that. Here's my talk with Tull Price. I'm curious kind of how Fight started.
I started running my own businesses when I was very young. I guess you could say I was quite entrepreneurial. At 16, a friend and I started putting on basically underage like dance parties, which ended up turning into raves once we were like 17. And after doing that for a year and a half, we started to realize that we had a bit of an audience. I then started to basically create a streetwear label that was, you know, clothing for guys and girls that we started selling to the same market. And then streetwear and printed t-shirts became bags, which then eventually a year later evolved into the idea of making sneakers without laces. And that became my first proper company, which was known as Royal. I spent 8 or 9 years building that up from the age of 19 to 27. The company was sold and slowly actually started to head south. And following my departure from that company, I started to look at building a higher end brand and taking everything which I had learned from the first experience and putting it into the second. That was Fight.
And what were some of those learnings that you wanted to kind of correct for or do differently?
Well, when I was in my late teenage years, it was the early to mid 90s, and I was very fascinated by the idea of globalization and that there was a world out there of kids who were living in Tokyo, London, Singapore, New York, Los Angeles, who were very much interested in the same thing, and that there was a capability to start to create a brand or products that could speak the same language, but to kids in all these different cities. And for me, it also represented if I could work out how to build a business that sold in those places, that I'd be able to travel around the world, which is what I really wanted to do. And of course, that's really expensive. But if you're able to build a business, then kind of your business trips are your leisure trips. It was an interesting globalization. And what I realized was that to create and sell a product globally, at least at that time, and to continue to build a business in that manner, you end up with huge amounts of pressure and requirements for growth. And as you have these pressures and requirements building up for growth, the tendency of most businesses in order to sell more is to make the products more affordable. And then in order to make the products more affordable, you look for ways to cut costs and cut corners. And I found that it kept coming out of basically the materials. And so the materials one uses and the designs one creates continues to get inhibited in order to get scale. And as I witnessed that, I saw, you know, the loss one of being able to really just create a great product, which was uncompromised. And then I also saw the massive amounts of waste and the massive amounts of energy it took to create these cheap synthetic materials, which we were ultimately using to build our products from. And I think that was the main lesson that I learned. And so after leaving that business, my desire was, how can I build a company in which the product remains uncompromised so that I can always use the best materials, the best makers, and create a product that people can really, really love that hasn't been watered down due to the requirements to scale, grow, and basically deliver greater profits.
Was it easy for you to kind of make that decision early on that scale was just not the goal?
It was in my mind clearly, but when I originally started Fight, I started it with my business partner from the first business, and he was more sales driven in his mentality. So we started Fight with that being the premise and that being the goal. But we fell a little bit into our old patterns, especially because that was his nature and his side of the business. And so we actually ran the business for about two or three years with, let's say, a balanced approach, my desire to head in the direction of purely focusing on making great product and not being concerned about sale or volume or growth, mixed with what was natural to him. And so after 2.5-3 years, we actually closed the entire business with the exception of a retail store, which we kept running. About a year after that, my brother purchased his shares, and he'd already been involved with the business, but he purchased his shares. And then we restarted the business again 2 years later, I think in 2010 or 2011, under the very clear regime of just focus on quality. Don't pay any attention to, you know, trying to scale or do volume or hit numbers. Just purely focus on the product. And also with that, adapt the business model to ensure that most of our business was direct, because the traditional wholesale business model is part of what puts this pressure on requiring numbers, requiring growth in place of what people might give up in margin or in place or just to meet the desires of retailers.
You started with the direct part. In how long did it take for retail to come into play and then kind of...
Our own retail? Or?
Yeah, your own.
We actually, when we started Fight originally, we opened a store in Sydney,
right.
Australia.
Which is still there, right?
Which is still right. There. So that was open from the beginning. And we had a very small web presence always from the beginning. But the first time we started at wholesale, you know, was still, I would say, equally as important. And then after we closed the business and when we relaunched it in 2010, then the focus was really on retail, online, direct, with limited but the right wholesale partners. And that's still where we are today.
I've seen it at Dover Street or a few other kind of select places, but I assume the majority of the business is very much your own and direct and in
exactly.
The stores.
Yeah, we have, like, at the moment, it's still a small business, but we have 3 retail stores, 2 in New York, 1 in Sydney, and then we have quite a good online business because we've been present in that space for a while and consistent.
How do you kind of balance the responsibilities or the split between your brother and yourself?
Well, my brother is based in Australia, so he handles everything to do with the Australian business now.
Gotcha.
Our offices used to be there, but they moved out to America when we restarted the business in 2010-11. So basically it's split. But I'm always, the product marketing guy.
Gotcha.
You know? So the more the creative side of the business, and he's been more on the managerial side of the business.
Gotcha. To get over to the product side of it, I feel like all of the products have a somewhat distinct style, which arguably goes along with kind of that different, relaxed, kind of minimalist. And I'm curious kind of where that came from.
Well, part of the learning curve and the desire after leaving the first business was really asking myself, what is the best way to make footwear? You know, what materials in a perfect world would one use? What constructions would one use? And then trying to select the best process, the best materials, the best construction, and then the best makers all over the world and putting them together. And so our design has very much been driven by that. It's not, I would say, design for design itself. It's design that's driven by construction and it's driven by material selection. And then that then shapes the look and the feel of the product. And it's ended up with the product looking quite minimal, not because we're trying to make it look minimal, but because we're trying to create the best possible product. And that just so happens to be the end result.
On that kind of same logic, then, do you believe that the best construction and materials will lead to, I don't want to say maybe the best design, but a really, really good design? Or are there still parts where you have to maybe like correct the course or something?
I think that the best construction and materials should lead to a good quality product, but not necessarily the best design, because someone can still take them and make a mess of it. You know, you've still got to get out of your own way if you're not a good designer. Or if you're a good designer, you know, there's still definitely a lot of considerations regarding, you know, balance and small amounts of detail where you're able to have detail. So design is still definitely part of it, but it's really, you know, the way that Fight's built, it was also about the desire to make a really great product, but then at the same time also something that's sustainable, not just for the people we work with and the makers that we work with or the planet, but also as a business, as a small business.
Given all the work that goes into finding like the vegetable leathers and all these problems, I'm curious kind of what research or process do you have kind of on that gets you to that finished product? Because I feel like it's a very, as you said before, kind of connected one with the makers and stuff, instead of, I think, what we see a lot in the industry today, which is just basically outsourcing and then just assuming someone in China or Asia is going to fulfill the promise and send it back. And I'm curious kind of how you manage that whole process.
It's very hands-on, and it has to be very hands-on in order to work. I was fortunate enough that I started in the industry really young, and I started in the industry at a time when there was no internet to find suppliers.
Alibaba.
Yeah, there was no Alibaba. I was finding factories still in the time where you had to hop on a plane and you had to fly to the country and you had to try find someone in the industry to talk to, and then you had to find someone else who knew someone else. And, you know, it was really a lot of like investigating work to a degree. So I got very used to, you know, searching out people and doing a lot of things by plane/foot. So I guess after, you know, I started doing that and then I continued to do that, and I've now basically been doing that for 21 years, you know, across most of the places where footwear or leather is manufactured. That slowly allowed me to really understand and work out, oh, that guy's good, but this guy's great, or this guy's amazing, or that person's a real talent, or this material supplier is just impeccable in their process and what they do. So I've been able to weed out, I guess, the weak spots and find the strong spots and those people who really do something amazing and different. And then based on the model we've created for Fight, we're not restricted from then using them. You know, because the whole model is, how do we make the best product? So it's not like we'll find a supplier who make amazing leathers and then, oh, the price is too high. We're not restricted in that manner, because our goal is always to make the best product and then to pass on the costs of making that product.
I would assume it's been incredibly freeing to not basically have any price ceiling pressure in a way.
Yeah, it's great. As this was my second, in a way, third footwear business, I wouldn't say I had the luxury to do that, but I had the luxury of knowing what type of business I want to be involved in long term. Due to trial and error, I was able to make a decision of, how do I want my life to feel? What do I really want to be involved in? And what do I really want to be doing? And let's make sure that this time I get that right in a sustainable manner, so that I can do this for 10 or 20 or 30 years, however long it goes on for, and enjoy it in the process.
And so I guess circling back to the retail question, I'm curious kind of how, when I look at the stores, there's something incredibly distinct about them from an architectural perspective and obviously from a lighting perspective and especially from a product perspective. I guess maybe since the Sydney one was there in version one, you kind of approached the two New York ones and kind of made, like, what purpose for you do they serve the brand that, let's say, given the kind of the luxuriousness of the product that you can't really get online?
You know, bricks and mortar retail and touch and feel is, you know, hugely important, especially for a product like ours. So we need the retail stores, firstly, just so that people can touch and feel the product. We're able to give people a sense of it online, and once they own a pair of Fight shoes, generally they buy several more pairs because they've had the experience. But bricks and mortar retail provide that opportunity off the bat, so that for a company like us, they're needed. And in my opinion, more important than our online business is our bricks and mortar retail business. Where it's also helpful versus wholesale is, you know, unfortunately, I mean, there are a few great retailers out there in the world, but a retailer's goal and desire is different to the brand's goal and desire. And nobody's going to look after your own business the way that you will. No one else is going to do that for you. And in your own environment, you can shape everything to suit that environment and to help explain your product. Our own retail also provides us with that capability and that independence. Then regarding the store design, look and feel, I think it's a combination of a few things. One, like with the sourcing of our products, I'm always trying to find, you know, great, talented people who are inspiring to work with in no matter what I do, especially if I have the time and focus. That's something that I really enjoy doing. So in part, there was already that desire when it came to the store. But then also, Fight isn't such a planned venture. It's a very step-by-step venture. And so part of it was just fortuitous in the fact that I happened to have a friend who was living in New York at the time, studying a Masters of Architecture, who was a installation and lighting artist. And we crossed paths at the right time, and they put up their hand, and it really worked. And her name's Jordana Macy. And so it was also partially coincidence. I mean, the stores would have had some type of character I'm sure we would have been proud and excited about. Also, the other interesting point about the stores is it's my natural desire, and I enjoy to do things a little bit differently. So instead of working with an architecture or a store design person on a store, we worked with who at that time was an installation and lighting artist. And so that made it, again, a little bit more of a creative pursuit and a less commercial pursuit. And then the desire with the store was to do something in a similar manner as to what we do the footwear. So again, let the construction lead design, let there be some innovation to the product through understanding construction and lighting and design. So I think the stores have done a good job at doing that, and then they showcase the product and they help to elevate the product. And so far, the reaction's been great.
So I guess more generally from a price perspective, you're able to use incredible quality materials and processes and makers, but obviously because you're less restrained or not at all restrained on price, you have the flexibility. Do you see a point in the industry or from a process perspective where the gap between what is possible than the resulting price of that continues to draw, maybe not necessarily for your brand, but for the industry as a whole?
I see there being as no way it's going to reduce. They're only going to go in the opposite direction. It might look like it reduces to certain people with products which they receive, but there's a lot of, I don't want to say tricks, but there are a lot of inherent things within the make and construction of a product which are not seen by a customer, but if they buy and wear a product, might be felt. Luxury brands, which are amazing, mostly the old luxury houses, are incredible. No, and they do an incredible, incredible job, and in many ways are the real deal. To me, part of their real genius is makeup. They're geniuses at makeup. So what do I mean by that? They can take a product and they can make its outside look like $1 million, you know, look like the most beautiful woman you've ever seen. But when you break it down and if you cut it in half, inherent within it, the soul within it, the constructions that they use, not on everything, they also have their really legitimate stuff that then really gets crazy and ridiculous in price, but the inherent constructions might not be great. But the outsides look amazing, and people therefore go and they're happy to spend very huge amounts of money on it. If you just look at something as simple as like Vuitton's really famous bucket bag that thousands of people buy around the world every single year for a very high price, it's all plastic, but it's iconic and people love it and people buy it. So inherently the quality of the materials that it's made out of, the feel of it isn't necessarily that great, but the makeup is unbelievable, so people buy into it. There are, just to be clear, there are luxury brands who are the real deal, who also on certain products of theirs do have the inherent quality on the inside. So there's always those tricks. So to me, when talking really about quality, I'm really thinking about integrity and top to bottom quality, you know, the material that's used, but also the construction that's used. And in order to create the construction, which I believe to be of the deepest integrity, it requires humans in the process. And the cost of human time and the cost of human labor is only going to get more and more expensive. It continues to get more expensive. The skills required to do those things get more limited, or they take longer in a sense to train, or at least more expensive to train because of what people are giving up in order to learn these things. And so I think that creating a truly deep product of great integrity that's really high end, there's just no chance for it to get cheaper, because just basically based on the cost of human time and the cost of natural materials. And I think those two things prices are just going to continue to go up.
It reminds me very much when you talk about the integrity part, the way that like Steve Jobs always talk about computers, which is making the inside just as beautiful as the outside, which is obviously what no one will see, but what as the maker or whatever is very important. Just to prod a little bit more on the sustainability part, from a cost perspective, if it is only going to get worse, I'm curious, is that sustainable generally? And then how do you approach that for your own business from a sustainability perspective if you know prices are going up?
I would say, unfortunately, yes. And I mean, the reason I would say unfortunately, yes, is, and hopefully it changes, but unfortunately, you know, we live in a world today where the gap between rich and poor is getting greater and greater. And the people who have money have more and more money. So whatever the inflation is of the cost of human time in the production process increases at, it's going to be still surpassed by the amount of money the very wealthy or the top 1% of people in the world are making. So in that sense, it's sustainable. You're always going to have a market which is able to afford things that take human labor more time to produce. So in that way, it's sustainable. I say unfortunately because, you know, it would be better to live in a society where the differences between the rich and the poor weren't as great. Even more than it's sustainable, it's stable. Mm. And that's also why we elected to go that direction.
You saw immense future potential for it, for better or worse, to stay this way.
I saw that the middle of the market was going to be the portion of the market that was going to disappear and that the market was going to split. And I saw that for a small business, it's impossible to go into the volume end. Basically impossible. For us, and by small business, I mean a small business that isn't backed with millions and millions and millions of dollars. In the business world that we exist in today for companies like this, you know, you only really have kind of three different options for survival. If you want to be part of the mass market, you better have tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to enter the market. Otherwise, you can't compete with the big guys. If you have like a protectable, patentable invention, that's great, then you can get in. Otherwise, you need to be more in the niche end of the business, and the niche end of the business can't rely on volume because that's as much a financing distribution game as it is anything else. And you need to be a pretty big boy to be able to play in that area.
It's interesting to hear you continue to talk about it as a small business, because I feel like generally today, so many, especially in the industry, brands are just going after scale or some sort of approximation of it. And there's almost something like humbling, but also maybe freeing about just knowing very early what your own goals are for it and then kind of keeping it within that box, as opposed to arguably what I think we've seen, which is basically you start something really, really niche and then you try and expand it really, really quickly and basically lose the integrity that made it what it was.
Yeah, well, I think I went through that once with my first business, and I think it all really comes down to what one's desire is with the business. We're not building Fight in order to make money. We're building Fight because it's a product we love to make. We love our customers to be able to buy it. So we're not going after scale. If one's desire or if our desire was simply to make money, we'd probably try going to a different business. You're better off being in the business of money than you are being in the business of footwear or being in the fashion business. Or if you are in the fashion business and that's your ultimate goal, then you go down the path of scale, which is, you know, extremely, extremely, extremely difficult to almost impossible to do nowadays, unless you're trying to change the business model, like going direct and doing it only online. But then again, you know, that road mainly goes one direction. Then it is about scale. And I think ultimately the product probably eventually suffers, although I think ultimately you still end up in the volume end of the business, unless you're, you know, like a small trader just making great things, you know, and selling very small units. But if you start going down that path and start scaling up, then ultimately it just heads one direction.
Right. I think there's also an interesting paradox, which is making products to last a really, really long time. But it sounds like the more people like them, the more they actually buy them. And so there's, again, in an industry that is predicated on obsolescence and all of this, there's an interesting, ultimately what it sounds like, successful business practice of making things that last a really long time, but then having people just want more of it.
I would agree. I think people like it, and people do seem to also love the fact that they buy a product for us, it lasts a long time. And if it breaks or something goes wrong, they bring it back to us, we repair it, so on and so forth. And I think that there is a beauty to that and things that people like. That said, it does reduce the amount of products people buy from us, and we see that in the trends of what people buy. People, you know, usually they buy their first pair and then they buy their second, third, fourth and fifth pair very quickly, and then we don't hear from them for a couple of years and then they come back. That seems to be the trend, but we're comfortable with that, you know, because our products aren't cheap. They're expensive products to buy, so they should last and they should be repaired. And again, the fact that our motivation isn't to just scale the business and make money. Our motivation is to stay in business and make great products. We're okay with that.
Right. Here's kind of in terms of just the width of the SKUs and all that. How did you decide what was the right amount of products to have, or is the right amount of products to have? And will that change at any point?
I don't think that there'll ever be a time where we'll all of a sudden be making very large amounts of new products in the season. The way that I view it is every product we try to create, our desire is that it's a product that is around for many, many years, and that it organically allows us to grow our line of products. So we don't try to duplicate products too much or make something that's almost the same as that, but a little bit different. So slowly, we just try to build the cornerstones of what we feel we need and what appropriate product is for the brand. And usually that's maximum one or two new styles of product a season. We might rematerialize right. or recolor old styles, but never a lot of new SKUs. And it also goes with the way that we view everything. It's just less is more. We don't really need more. People don't really need more. So make one or two new things a season and try to get them right.
Which I assume, is it also fair to say that given the large cost of developing footwear as well, that kind of impacts the bottom line, or a nice sort of alignment there.
Exactly.
That you're not having to throw out everything every season.
Exactly. You know, we live in a world where there's so much waste in everything that gets done. And that was one of the things that I recognized with my first business and wanted to change with the second business. So we have to be humble and precise and accurate on everything that we do in order to make the model work.
I'm curious from also maybe like a timelessness perspective of, again, given the speed everyone just keeps yapping about this industry is moving, that the product itself has essentially stayed in relevance from, I guess, the beginning, or from at least when I started paying attention to it. And I'm curious what you think that says, again, maybe about the product and the material, that in a time where many people are basically forced to rewrite their brain every 3 months, that you can continue kind of just drilling down on the same evolutionary vision or something that still seems to resonate.
I think it's probably a combination of a few things. I think that the first thing is, you know, like with my first business, I was very interested in the idea of globalization. And that also was, to a degree, my inspiration when it came to how does the brand look, how does the brand feel, and what products does it create. You know, globalization is still evolving. That initial period of globalization has changed, and what globalization is becoming very different to what it was viewed as initially. And so with Fight, again, the socio-economic trend that I had interest in, that I saw coming up, was this desire for something that's made better, something that's sustainable, something that lasts longer, something with deeper integrity, something which is not fast fashion. And so to begin, I'd say our products are still relevant today as really when we started, based on the fact that we're probably only still a third of the way through that cycle. And I think that that cycle is going to continue for a long period of time. So that will help our products stay relevant. Then based on the fact that we've let, again, construction and materials lead design, which has led to a minimal aesthetic, I think that gives the product life and longevity. And then I think we are probably benefiting a little bit at the moment from the upward trend in, even though it's maybe peaking now, but the last few years, upward trend in sportswear, and the fact that that was an industry I grew up in and a period that I grew up being influenced by. So the silhouettes we take, even though they're very minimal and they're a fusion of athletic and like bespoke men's product, even though they're the combination of that, they still can speak to that trend. And so I think that has helped us a little bit, but that's something that will go away. And it will be interesting to see how people react once that trend's gone to some of our products who have been inspired by, you know, the 50, 60, 70 sportswear.
What is kind of the process for designing a style for you? And then also, what's the timeline of that?
I think a lot of it comes out of sometimes thinking, okay, what do we need? We already have these other things available to our customer. What haven't we done for our customers yet that they may want? And then how would we do that in our way. I think that that's part of the process. And then sometimes it's also just feeling what's going on, or what product would I like to wear? What don't I feel like I have? You know, what is everybody else feeling about products? And then there isn't really a lengthy design process. It's more a thinking process that goes on in my head. And then at some point I start to see it. Oh, okay, that's what's missing, or that's what we need to do. And maybe at a point I'll scribble that down, but usually I'll just go and start working with pattern makers in the factory and kind of create it.
I'm curious if you could talk a bit about kind of the sort of craftsmen you seek out, how you work with them, what's that process like? And then again, kind of what the importance of that is for you in the process.
Yeah, I think really what I'm always looking for is a similar mindset. I'm trying to find someone who is very passionate about the work they do. They have a very high level of skill. And really, even though contrary to what a lot of people, you know, think is the right thing to do for a business, really looking for someone who's doing it more for love and for the product that they're creating versus, this is a business I'm running, I'm going to make this set of lasts for you and I'll make good money off them, but I don't really care too much about them as long as the price is right and I'm making my money. So I'm really looking for craftsmen versus, you know, businesses or business people. And in order to create the Fight products the way that we want to have them, which is to be an exceptional product and product which is a different experience to all the products that are out there, those are the types of people I have to seek out. So for example, with the people who, you know, hand sew our footwear, it took me 12 or 13 years to find or to be able to put together the structure that we have, which allows us to create our products in the way that we do. And it's not that I wasn't looking for that at the beginning. I was, but it just really took a long time to find. And it took a long time to wade through all of the different tanneries that are out there and all of the different material suppliers and component suppliers that are out there, you know, to really make sure that we found ones who create a good product. And in my opinion, in order to create a good product, or at least the one I want, the type of product we want for Fight products, there needs to be a high level of like love and passion in what the person does. Most of the components we make also are, you know, created by hand or treated by hand. And so there's a human in that process. It's not just being pumped out of a machine. So it's not like you can just walk up, place an order, and it'll print you 500 of those that'll be exactly the same. Everything has a very high degree of human involvement in it, whether that person cares about what they're doing or doesn't care about what they're doing, or whether they've had a large amount of experience or haven't had a large amount of experience, makes all the difference.
When you're looking for that craftsmanship, is that something you see, or is that something you kind of hear when people talk about it, or both, in terms of, because I assume there's some language barriers, right, as well, when you're seeking these people out? And is it something where you can kind of go into a situation and just look and go, oh, you know, I can see the craftsmanship here?
110%, you can definitely see it. You can see it via the work. That's number one. And you look at that and you see it. And then, you know, there's also a lot of things that are, let's say, that look good at the work on the surface, but you need to dig deeper. And those things you can often see via the people. I mean, for example, you know, like Fight is one footwear company I've been involved with and is obviously our family business and something I'm very passionate about. But I've worked with a lot of other footwear companies and also worked with a very large amount of factories. And I can tell you, for example, when I go to factories in Italy, an important cue is often if the papa's still there, you know, so if the grandfather's still there. You know, a lot of these Italian, whether they're factories or tanneries, have been passed on from one generation to the other, and often were set up by not the generation running it at the moment, but by the generation prior. And often when that generation passes away, if they haven't taught their kids properly, that business, you know, really heads down the wrong direction, and a lot of things kind of pass away with the person who originally started the factory, and their skill set falls and their attention to detail falls. So for example, when it comes to factories, sometimes that's a telltale sign. If the old guy's still there and he's working the factory floor, you know that they've got more experience. Sometimes they, of course, pass it on very well, and then you don't have a problem. But I've seen situations where factories have been great, and then the father has passed away and has left it with his kids who are in their 40s, perhaps, but they just don't have that same skill, and then the factory changes completely.
Given kind of the importance of craftsmanship in everything you do, like, how do you decide where to spend your time, whether it's in the factories? What are you doing in those factories? How do you kind of maintain those relationships?
I've always liked to spend time at factories and tanneries. I kind of have a circuit, I guess, that I do, which kind of repeats more or less every 6 months, where, you know, I'm spending time thinking about the products we're building for the next 6 months, then touring tanneries and factories, building the products. I do spend a lot of time at the factories throughout, like, the sampling and the development process. You know, a lot of Fights footwear doesn't often also get designed. Sometimes we just build it. You know, we don't design it. Maybe I've scribbled it onto a napkin or something like that. Sometimes we do design it, but sometimes often we don't. And so I have to spend a lot of time, you know, building it and working with the pattern makers and the hand sewers. And also I think that's given me benefits when it comes to design. When you understand how something's being made, then you understand how you can change it or evolve it or improve it. If you don't really understand how it's being made and you're not really watching how it's being made, all you really understand is how to draw it, and then you pass it on to someone who then will try work it out. The more you can understand about those bits of process, the more it's able to, at least for me, it's been able to help with trying to evolve the product beyond the norm.
And I'm sure then a much kind of deeper collaboration with the craftsmen themselves, right? Because you kind of speak that same language.
Definitely. I would say to a certain degree, everything I've learned has almost come from that. You know, at the beginning, maybe I had ideas, but I didn't really know anything. And it took, you know, meeting and working with people who were more expert than myself over the years to build up that knowledge. I think you can think of some things for yourself, imagine some things for yourself, but a lot of things you need to learn from someone else.
I'm curious how you kind of talked about build versus design, and maybe to kind of like dive into that a bit more. Like, what does that mean for you, and kind of when do you build versus when you design, if it's even that kind of systematic?
By build versus design, I mean, instead of sitting down and thinking, you know, what type of product do we want to design for next season, and then drawing a whole bunch of products and looking at them, and then, oh, we like this or we don't like that, and maybe we could do this, and then having a final design, which one then submits to someone, I would call that design. Build is more when maybe I'm working with the craftsmen, seeing how they're building our shoe for the current season and thinking about how could we improve that product for next season. And when I see them doing one bit of the process, I might be like, can we take that bit of the process out? Why are we doing it that way? Would we be able to do it this way? We've heard from customers that the sole is cracking a little bit here. Can we change that? Could we put something, you know, this, that type of thing. That's what I would call, you know, actually building. And then, you know, a lot of our products are one piece, and because they're built on this one piece system, there comes a lot of challenges. You can only build a shoe so high with one piece of leather. The pattern can only be so big. And so we're always coming up against these challenges that we have to overcome at the making level to see, is that actually possible? Is it not possible?
And so where did that one piece system kind of come from?
People have been making one piece shoes for a long time. To a great degree, it had really died out. You know, when we started making all of the Fight products that way, there was some of it was hanging around mainly in bespoke men's dress shoes. At one point, most shoes may have been made that way. But what business found was that was not the most cost-effective way of making a product. So at some point, people started to realize that if they wanted to get better leather usage out of the materials they had, that they should be making shoes out of smaller pieces because they could get more shoes per skin.
Right. The yields
of leather.
Go up.
Yeah, exactly. The yields increase. So business, that was a business decision really at a point, I believe, was a business decision. And at that point you had, you know, maybe in footwear for the first time where costs started to infringe on quality. And so with Fight, because we wanted to make the best products possible, I became aware over time that probably that was the best way of making shoes, that seams are unnecessary, except when it comes to cost, seems unnecessary. But for the way that a shoe breaks and the way that a shoe feels, really, they're just an irritant and they're really not helping. When we ask ourselves the question with all Fight products is, what is the best way to make this product? How will this product be most comfortable and durable and kind of age nicely? That was the answer.
Is it fair to say that seams are some of the least durable part of a shoe or something? Or
I don't think you can say. I think the seams very durable because, you know.
Or sorry, not your seams, but if you have, let's say, 15 seams on a shoe, is it a safe bet that those are kind of some of the wear and tear areas, or not necessarily?
Maybe in a way. Look, if you've got something sewn, it can come apart. But the main issue is, if you use a great quality material, a great quality skin, it can then break and move the way that you move. And the more seams you put in, the more you stop doing that. And like I said, proper shoes used to be made that way once. All of Fight shoes are made that way, but you can even see that the athletic industry has come around to that point of view. I mean, all of the products now that are really getting sold, whether it's the Flyknit or this or that, it's, you know, seamless. So they've also taken it out, perhaps for different reasons. You know, I think they've taken it out for a combination of reason. One is comfort, you know, legitimately for comfort. Two is less human labor because, you know, you're removing the person with a sewing machine, sewing the seam together, and I'm sure that's cheaper.
How did you end up with leather kind of as that preferred material? And then do you ever see yourself expanding to alternatives or staying put?
I started in what I would call more the athletic manufacturing world with the goal of always wanting to make a better and better product. Ultimately, that led me back to natural materials. And that's where I really started learning about leather. So I was like, okay, so maybe a better athletic shoe would be out of, in my opinion, at least how it feels and breathes, so on and so forth, would be out of real leather. And then I started understanding, oh, and most of these leathers are treated like this, and they're treated with me. And then, oh, you can treat them like this. And so it was basically a path that was just always for me looking, how do I elevate? How do I create a better product? And in the end, it led me in a way, you know, back to the beginning, or, you know, earlier periods of shoemaking, or probably very close to the very beginning, which was, you know, using natural materials in the most natural form possible. And to me today, I still believe for a quality product with great depth, that's still the best material to use. And so that's what we use on our products. Whether or not that will change, I can't be sure. But I think at this point, it's unlikely, unless people stop eating meat, I think that we'll be using leather to create Fight products.
And you say that because the leather is, I assume, you're getting the byproduct of.
Yeah, the leather's a byproduct.
Right.
The only thing I think that's maybe, you know, a little uncomfortable about leather is obviously it comes from an animal and a living creature. But the fact of the matter is that we eat meat and it's there and it's a byproduct. So if we didn't eat meat, I would probably, you know, need to really heavily think about the use of leather. But at this point in time, the world does.
Do you find that the constraints, be it that one piece construction or having basically leather or suede as your options, like, do you find those empowering in a way? Do you find them frustrating? Like, how do you kind of approach, I don't want to say they're self-imposed, but some of them.
They are self-imposed. And it's a good decision to stick to, but it's true, you know, like, it's been frustrating to know that over the last 5 years or 4 years, there was going to be this huge resurgence in like laceless athletic style silhouettes, you know, built out of synthetic materials, which was really the first vision I had for footwear 20 plus years ago, that was going to have a big resurgence and that we couldn't really be part of it. That was a little bit frustrating for sure. There was a lot of ideas that we had to just leave on the table because we try not to use synthetics in any way whatsoever. And so that rules us out of a lot of, you know, stretchable materials, so on and so forth. So yes, that was frustrating. But it keeps our brand pure and it keeps our brand focused. And I think it's a nice focus to have. And, you know, what's still really lacking in the market is still products of great depth. And I think that the only way to really, really get the depth is by the use of natural materials, you know, that have been treated naturally. You can build great products from synthetic materials, but they seem to be lacking, you know, they're lacking something.
One of the mechanisms to attest to the handmade nature of this was kind of this numbering system that you use on probably all the products, yeah, right? And so I'm curious kind of what was the origination of that idea, and then has it evolved, and kind of what purpose does it serve for you and also to the customer?
It was actually evolved from the idea of wanting to connect the person who was making the product with the person who was buying the product. The idea was, let's have the person, when they finished hand sewing the product, sign the product, and then also number the pair. And that's where it came from originally. We also wanted people to understand that it's not a mass product. We only were able to make 70 pairs of that shoe. We're also not limiting it by design. I mean, we're limiting it based on what we can afford to create as a company. Often we're also limiting it based on what materials we do or don't have available. So again, it was more about connecting the maker to the customer, also about transparency, and also, you know, helping people to understand that we can't just pump these out in thousands and thousands of pairs of volume, that this product takes a long time to make, and therefore we can only make so many.
I mean, it was always nice to kind of open a new, whether it was the wallet or whatever, and just realize, like, I mean, I think the wallet, those were like one of eight or one of 12. It was so cool to be like, yeah, I have, you know,
yeah,
8% of the world circulation of this product is like a really, it was always a really cool thing.
I think it's nice. And we've become so, everything is so mass. I guess it's a real push against that. It's this desire. I think people enjoy having something that's special. It wasn't such a unique thing pre the 80s, do you know, pre mass production, really when mass production really got going in the apparel and footwear industry, which was probably the end of the 70s or something like that. A lot of things were one-offs. I mean, if you go back and you look at any film footage from the 70s, like if you watch any documentaries from the 70s or anything like that, almost everything people have is a one-off or something. Maybe their Levi's jeans weren't, but most of the things that people were buying, a woven woolen jacket or this or that, was one of a kind or one of 10. And then I guess, you know, as mass production automation increased, you know, volumes went up and things got more and more mass produced. And then people started to wear more similar things to one another because that's what was available. And so I guess, you know, with Fight, we just think it's nice to have something that's not that.
And then on that note, I'm curious of both where the kind of the clothing started to come in, where you, maybe fair to say you're dabbling a bit, and then also the male versus female. And was it always like that, or did one come before the other? Or?
Well, in the male versus female, we started completely male, and then it's only in the last 24 months that we took our male silhouettes and started making them on female last. So we haven't been designing at all specifically for female, but we just had a lot of girls, you know, coming in, a lot of women, girls coming in and, you know, buying the 40s, you know, the size 7s and the size 8s, and then a lot of people complaining that there wasn't a 6 or a 5. So it was really demand that drove that, and then all we did was we took our classic styles and just made them on a woman's last. So that's the male versus female side. In terms of other things, yeah, we have dabbled a little bit here and there in the making of other products, mainly on the leather goods side, but we did make a t-shirt here or there. I think that for those people who have bought 3 or 4 pairs of shoes, they're still around and they have the desire to buy something else. We often get asked, could you make this or could you make that? And so I guess it was responding to that. We haven't done much of it, but I think going forward, what I'm also realizing is in order to sustain the very limited line of footwear we have, we're probably best off adding products to it that are non-competitive, like a t-shirt or a jacket or whatever it might be, because it'll allow us to keep to our mission on the footwear, which is only making the best products. Because otherwise, with our footwear, then at some point, if you want to keep making other things, you're starting to make things that maybe you don't really need. And I don't want to do that either.
Interesting. And so does that mean stuff like handbags or other bigger accessories are not on
par? Yeah, I mean, we don't have a set plan at the moment and we haven't totally decided, but we play around with things from time to time. And I think when we have products that we feel are kind of worthy or meet the mark or maybe have a need, then we'll make them. Yeah.
Yeah. You launched this beautiful new website and I'm curious if you kind of talk about the process behind it, what you were looking to kind of bring to the table that wasn't there and yeah, kind of what went into that project.
We'd been feeling that although we talk a lot about the backbone of the company and the things which are most important to us, that we hadn't really clearly spelt it out. So it was time to refresh our website. And so when we did that, at the core of refreshing it was really just to clearly explain to people what the backbone of the brand was, why our products are made the way they're made and how they're made, basically.
A big part of that in terms of the backbone was this focus on kind of the process and the craftsmanship and all that, which kind of brings you to this point where you're still an e-commerce site, but you're also kind of talking about that story. How did you kind of figure out or get to the point of telling that story that way, breaking them up into the series, and then also kind of reflecting that in emails and on social and all that?
Yeah, we broke them up into two sections, really, which was the two areas where we really focus, which is one is either construction and then the other's materials. And then we wanted to delve more deeply into each one of those and what is special about the way we make our construction and what's special about the materials that we use. And so we took a deep dive into each of those.
Why do you think the power of these craftsmen is so invisible to both people in the industry and consumers more broadly?
The American capitalist system is very, very focused around growth. And by virtue of the fact that it's focused continuously around this quarterly growth means that the people who work within it are always forced to do things more quickly and in a way look for things that are cheaper and cut corners on what they do. So it's the opposite of going into something in depth. And by virtue of all of those things, the materials they tend to buy or the suppliers they tend to work with are working under similar conditions with similar goals. And so that leads down the road to using either cheaper leathers or leathers which are tanned in the ways where it's best suited for volume and materials which are more synthetic and more treated because they tend to be more stable and they have less wastage, even though they may not be nicer to wear. And so I think for all of those reasons, a lot of the industries may be blind to it or they're aware of it, but they don't get the opportunity to use those types of materials. I think that also the American footwear industry was mainly dominated by athletic brands. And so a lot of the people who have the experience in that industry have either come from athletic brands or worked in and around athletic brands. And obviously they used very different material sources to what high-end companies do. And most of the expertise, even though it is starting to develop in America at the moment, most of the expertise in the higher end footwear has really been European based. Even at times when America has had, you know, quite successful large footwear brands, they're usually volume and price driven. And so again, they're fast, you know, fast in, fast out, cheaper price.
You talk about kind of that knowledge or the need to have the knowledge on the brand side. But there's also, again, if you read the copy in these new sections and all that, there's also seems like the effort to translate that to the consumer and to kind of push that knowledge to the consumer. And I'm curious kind of what's the thinking or the importance that you place behind not only people on the brand side knowing this, but also that the consumers buying it know kind of that tradition or that.
People want transparency. Also, the products that we create are not cheap and people need to understand why. There's more interest in it than there has been in the last 10 or so years. And so I think people enjoy, you know, hearing about how something's made, where it's made, where the materials come from, why it's made that way. We live in a world where there's been so much, you know, mass production and mass consumption that a lot of people are looking, you know, now for something unique and special. And so in order for them to understand it correctly, they need to us to explain to them, you know, this is why we make our shoes like this. And this is the benefit of making shoes that way. And these are the types of materials we source. And these are the reasons why we use those materials and not just, it looks good. It was a good price. So we decided to use that.
Yeah, no, definitely. certainly. I'm curious, what is it? Because, I mean, I assume it's fair to say that your career has been made of footwear, and that has kind of been it. Is there anything specific that drew you to that in the first place? Is it something that you kind of more landed in your lap? Or
it was very coincidental. I think that I actually started with clothing at the very, very beginning. Actually, even before that, I started in events. I mean, me and my first business partner used to put on, I guess for a want of a better word, like raves in our late teen years. And that was how I first actually made some money. And from that, I turned that into then, we had so many kids coming to these raves, and then I turned that into, they're coming to our parties, so maybe I can make some clothing for them. And I turned that into like a small streetwear label, which became bags and then eventually became shoes. But that was a 3 or 4 year period, and the next 20 I spent in footwear. Yeah, so my career has been very, you know, very, very footwear oriented, but it was not the plan. I just kind of moved from one thing to the next. I think more than anything, I was a person who was able to see kind of future trends, but not trends in the sense of, you know, what someone may or may not want to wear next season, although I think I can do a little bit of that, but more larger socioeconomic trends, like for the next 10 or 15 years, I really believe that the same approach that people are taking to food of farm to table, they're going to want to take to their consumer goods, for example. Or with our first footwear company with Royal, which was laceless, it was this belief that all athletic shoes are being designed for athletics. There should be lifestyle-based designs within the athletic shoe area, and that I believe a large portion of those designs should not have laces. That was arguably a 10-year period, which kind of lasted, went away, and now is back.
Yeah, Nike just released those yesterday. They like brought the Back to the Future ones
right,
back.
Right. Now it seems to be back and at its strongest, you know. So I think that probably that was my real skill, but then I just happened to apply it in the area of footwear. And then after spending so many years of just doing the same thing, I guess it became the area that I became an expert in.
Where did the name come from?
Well, Fight was basically, it was describing the departure from, you know, my first company. I built that up and I sold it to K-Swiss. And after I'd sold it to them, which was a large public company, I realized what I was missing by not being part of a product-focused smaller company. And so it was the desire to go from something large back to something small, where our focus was purely on creating the best product. So Fight is really, it really means like struggle, you know, struggle to, you know, do something that you love, do it really well despite all the odds. And so it's kind of a little bit of a big versus small, David versus Goliath type of thing.
What's been the most kind of rewarding part of this?
I mean, it's all the challenge. You know, running a small business is always a challenge, and that's what I enjoy about them. I think it's a rewarding process to find and collaborate and work with people who are really great at what they do, and who are very passionate about what they do, and who are driven by things other than money and profit. And I think that bit has been really rewarding. And as I get older, I think I continue to see, at least for me, how important that is as part of my life, you know? And like most industries, a lot of people are just in it for the buck, and it's a very different type of person than the people who are really passionate about what they do. I guess sometimes it can be combined right as well, you know, which is a great skill also. But for me, working with people who are really passionate about what they do and who are really trying to make the best product, I think that's probably the most rewarding thing.
Thanks for talking, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the 8th episode of the Loose Threads podcast. If you enjoy what we're doing, join the newsletter at loosethreads.xyz and feel free to leave a review on iTunes. We always appreciate it. Tull and I actually had two conversations which turned into the episode you listened to today. He's just so great to talk to and really has that macro perspective that is so rare in the fashion world. We have a great roster of guests in the next few episodes, including Mark Bain, Garrett Light, Vishal Mawani, and Stephen Allen. Enjoy the rest of your day and talk to you soon.